You're listening to Face Off, episode 99, recorded December 13th, 2010. This episode of Face Off is brought to you by AgileTask. AgileTask is a task tracking application featuring an agile workflow, tagging for organization and achievements. AgileTask, your lightweight personal backlog tool. Check it out by going to agiletask.me. And RocketShipIt. RocketShipIt, the complete web-based multi-carrier shipping solution for small businesses and developers. Shipping rates, integrated tracking, and labels for UPS, FedEx, and USPS shippers. RocketShipIt is shipping made easy. Go to rocketshipit.it. Welcome to Face Off, your face-to-face web technology podcast. I am one of your hosts, Jade Robbins.
And I am the other host, Mark Sanborn.
The other prestigious host, Mark Sanborn. In this podcast, we talk about the coolest stuff happening in web technology, which includes things like web development, social media, and web entrepreneurship. As always, you can get the show notes for this episode by going to faceoffshow.com. The notes are going to be good because we actually have a lot of stuff that we want to talk about. Let's get right into it. Well, first of all, first follow-up note I wanted to talk about is I actually got a new phone. We talked about it in the show when I first got the Droid. So my new every two-year contract thing, because I'm on Verizon, came up because I used someone else's in my family's upgrade to get that phone originally. So my, you know, came up and... So Amber decided she wanted the Droid, and so I could upgrade. So I got the Droid Pro, which is a pretty cool little phone. You know, the funny thing is it's sort of the BlackBerry form factor where it's kind of the candy bar with the keyboard in front. And it feels very much like a BlackBerry. Everything's very slippery and plasticky on the outside. But it's really fast. And I don't know. You know what we were talking about, though, is it was funny when we went from like my Windows Mobile smartphone to this to the Android one, and you went from your other phone to the Android one. It was like awesome. It was amazing. It was like, you know, someone had turned the light on. And I'm here to tell you, when you go from like a Droid to a Droid, it's not that fantastic anymore. Well, not fantastic. I guess it's fantastic. It's just not quite as... I mean, I guess I was expecting this sort of same jaw-dropping experience I had as the first time around.
Yeah, the Droid was my first smartphone, and I couldn't go back now. I mean, I'm a smartphone guy now. I think the rest of the world is kind of migrating that way anyways. But yeah, it was an amazing experience. When I first got the Droid, I played with it probably all day long, and it's cool because it updates and you can add apps and all that good stuff. I'm kind of jealous you got the Droid Pro. How do you like it? I mean, I guess it's a little better, say, you know, now that you're saying it's not as cool as the first experience with the Droid.
Well, but. Yeah, and I think that's just because it's not quite as new. I do like the form factor a lot more, even though the keys are smaller than the other Droid. I find it a little bit easier to type on because I used to have a Motorola Q, which I think was like basically their sort of, it's, you know, the same form factor with the screen above and the keyboard below, and I really liked that, and I was kind of upset that it was sort of, you know, designated like the BlackBerry form factor because I'd used it for quite some time and I thought I'd never be able to get that form factor again without like it being a BlackBerry. And now that they came out with the Droid Pro, I can get it with the form factor I like with the operating system that I really like. So I'm glad they did that. The one thing I was thinking about, though, is it's funny. When we got our Droids, I mean, I look at my current, you know, Droid Pro, and it's super smooth, like especially pinching text to zoom and stuff. And, you know, looking at when we got our Droids, they were the faster, you know, Droid model that came out on Verizon's launch. And some people even bought the Droid Eris, which was, you know, an even slower version. And I just can't imagine how they feel because, you know, the Droid, which was sort of like the Cadillac of it at the time, is like getting really slow for me compared to stuff now. So I imagine those people with like the old Droid Erises are really starting to notice its slowness. It's probably really starting to bug them.
Yeah, my brother, I think he's got the Eris. It's the slower of the Android ones that was offered on Verizon. And I, you know, he was kind of on the fence when he was going to get his phone a few months ago. And I suggested a smartphone because of how handy it is. And he was a little reluctant. I've asked him recently, you know, how do you think, you know, how do you use it? He's like, oh, I don't really use the internet and stuff all that much on it. And I think it's because it's a little bit slower than the Droid. I think the Droid is kind of the sweet spot, and it'll only improve from there. But I think those are a little slow for for first users.
Yeah, I would be frustrated about it too. But then again, my old phone, like I said, it was Windows Mobile. And I mean, even though it was a smartphone, quote unquote, you know, that experience made it really hard to swallow. And I could see how someone, you know, if they have a slow one, could find the experience not as awesome as like you and I see it, you know, because we're totally pumped about it and we thought it was great. So check it out. I like the Droid Pro. I think it's good. Let's move on to our next news and follow-up, which is that in episode 6, so a long time ago, it's funny, we're approaching episode 100, which we'll talk about, but you know, so way back in episode 6, we talked about a site called CoffeeNatic, which we found out, thanks to one of our listeners, is no more. That website no longer exists, but the reason he let us know is because he was looking for information about it, found our show, and decided to let us know that, you know, he is creating or has a website that is very similar that we want to talk about. So Alex started ratetea.net, which is very similar to CoffeeNatic, where you go in and you can rate different types of tea. And I, you know, I think this is a really cool website. I think I like it a little bit more than CoffeeNatic because I like coffee, but I find I just don't really have a refined palate for coffee. I don't know. Like coffee, for the most part, to me, tastes the same. I mean, I can tell a little bit, but in general, I can't taste coffee. But that, you know, like sometimes you go to coffee shops and they're like, our drip coffee of the day has a, you know, some slight nutty overtone with a nice, you know, crisp burnt back end. And you're like, I can't. It tastes like coffee to me. But tea, I found tea has, you know, a much larger sort of spectrum of flavor. So there's a lot more room to explore. So I'll check it out. He's on the website. He's very active. Alex is. He's rating a ton of teas. There's all kinds of cool teas. Black tea, green tea, herbal tea, whatever you want. So, I mean, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, I'd like to rate a tea that I tried with you, I think it was 2 weekends ago, is pine needle tea, which sounds just ridiculous, right? You'd expect it to taste kind of like a pine needle, I guess.
You wanted gin-tasting tea. Just admit it. You were trying to make gin, and you're
thinking
still
like juniper berries that smell of pine. You're just thinking right. Like gross. But it actually tastes a lot like, I would say, Tang.
That was the flavor we found. Yeah, it was kind of a survival thing where if you have hot water, you know, you can throw some pine needles in, gives it a little flavor, makes it kind of a nice treat. Plus, it has a lot of vitamin C in it. So that's where I think the Tang flavor comes from. I like it. When I'm walking out in the mountains, I'm always chewing on pine needles. So I thought it was really good. But it was funny because I think you and Rob were a little more reluctant. You know, you wanted to try it. But once you taste it, you're like, wow, that tastes like Tang, and it tastes pretty darn good.
Yeah.
So you should. You should rate it on here.
Shocked me for sure.
So you should rate it on here for Alex. We want to thank you, Alex, for giving us that follow-up. We appreciate it. Hey, speaking of follow-ups, we have another one. So, a while ago, I can't remember. We talked about using telephony in your web apps, things like SMS integration and voice integration, things like that. Another quick follow-up, there is another web service out there that offers really cool and easy telephony integration. It's called Tropo. So I want to thank our buddy Rob Lund. I was looking at it on the programmable web, and people seem to be pretty happy with it. It's getting a lot of new mashups. So I think it's, you know, it and Twilio, I think, are kind of battling out for the definitive telephony API app. But they have a lot of the same functionalities, and they both look like great web apps. So thank you, Rob, for following up on that. We actually have been playing around with our app. Rob played around with the Twilio API to sort of integrate a way to submit tasks via SMS. So that's cool. And so he's going to try out Tropo 2, and he'll let us know what he thinks.
Sweet. It's always good to have choice when it comes to things like that.
Absolutely. Because when we first read about Twilio, I was like, this is amazing and revolutionary, and there's nothing like it. But I'm glad to see that there's other services catching up as well, because they'll start competing, and hopefully we'll get, you know, maybe either they'll differentiate a little bit from each other, or, you know, we'll get good prices on a service that is pretty cool.
Also, one thing to note that I kind of noticed, picked up on this one right away, is the pricing plan for development. It's unlimited and free.
Yeah, that's cool.
You pay for the phone number, of course, if you want an actual phone number that you can call in to test. But other than that, it's all free. I think Twilio, you pay by the minute, and you get free minutes to start with to develop.
Yeah, they give you like dollars. They give you like $30 of Twilio dollars to test with. But yeah, if you're integrating like a full blown big, you know, mamma jamma app, then it's nice to know that you can test against like the developer number for free.
Or if you're doing like test driven development, you want to run your tests a lot against your production one when you switch over.
Totally.
It could be handy for that too.
So check it out, tropo.com. Our last sort of news and follow-up bit is, a little while ago we did an episode on payment options. We talked about one payment option called Amazon's Flexible Payment System. And I want to do a little more follow-up of it because we just switched over from PayPal to Amazon FPS for AgileTask. And I have to say, I was really pleased with the experience. I think Amazon, of course, you know, their what do you call it? Webs, or what do they call it? Amazon
Web Services.
Amazon Web Services are really great. Great APIs. We were able to integrate it fairly quickly. It had a little bit more control. And what was cool about that, we found out, was with PayPal, if you're doing small payments, they announced the new PayPal micropayments, but you have to switch over your entire account to just micropayments. And if you go over a specific amount, that the rate that they charge you spikes dramatically. And what we found with Amazon is cool is they let you basically do any spectrum, and they sort of adjust, you know, from like $1 to $5 is this lower percentage, you know, 5 to like 20 is this other percentage. So it really scales. You can do any size you want. So like we wanted $2 a month for AgileTask. So now you can subscribe to AgileTask for $2 a month. But also later, if we want to, we can integrate it so that you can buy a whole year for, you know, $20 or $24. And we won't be penalized, you know, huge percentage fees or anything like that. So that was a big plus for Amazon Flexible Payment. Two other interesting ones that my coworker sent me is that the one is called Zipwire. It's XIPwire.com. And it looks like to be sort of a payment system that is geared towards paying with your phone, which people are saying is going to become huge in the U.S. because it's really big in Japan right now. But as our infrastructure sort of catches up or attitude towards payments change, you'll be paying for a lot more things with your phone is what some people are guessing. So that's cool that Zipwire does it. Another one is Bitcoin. Bitcoin is an interesting one in that it's supposed to be distributed and you get coins and you send coins to other people. But these are two pretty different ones. So check them out, Zipwire and Bitcoin, if you want to look at alternate ways to try and get money into your web app.
Excellent.
Yeah, always. Like we said, options. There's a lot of cool stuff happening on the web these days, so it's cool that these guys are doing all this cool stuff.
The other thing to note before we leave this part is the Amazon Flexible Payment System. What I really liked about them is they had a resource center, and they had basically libraries for every language. So they really catered to the developer, made it easy on the developer, whereas PayPal is more, I guess, geared towards the business and how great they... you know, their percentages are and things. So.
Well, yeah, and like, so for example, for PayPal integration, we used Active Merchant, which is a plugin for Rails, or maybe it's just a Ruby library in general, but and it was pretty heavyweight just for PayPal payments. It's sort of a thing that it's meant to integrate with all different kinds of payment systems, but we did have to use a third-party thing for it. Now, with Amazon, they gave us really simple, easy-to-use example libraries that we just threw in and integrated. We didn't have to have that whole heavy plugin or framework or anything. And in the end, I mean, we really know what our payment system is doing now. Before, it was kind of like, oh, call the Active Merchant, it takes care of it, you know, it's kind of that Rails magic stuff. But with this, it was a good, simple library that they gave you examples to. We were able to change it and integrate it and use it. And I think we know, I mean, we really, really know what's happening now. I mean, there's no question because we had to do it all. So let's move in to our geek tool of the week. Our geek tool of the week actually comes to us via Mark Sanborn, who has been raving about this product for so long. It's Rain-X. I don't know. I never really heard nor used this until you told me about it. But Rain-X is really cool. Why don't you tell us about it, Mark, since it's like one of your favorite products of all that. I mean, you talk about it all the time.
So, you know, this is one of those products that, you know, your uncle Bob Joe just raves about, or, you know, your friend Mark Sanborn. I learned about it from my grandpa that lived in Florida, which, you know, it rains just ridiculous. It's like Seattle over there. It just rains a lot. And, you know, it's one of those things also that you can really see the difference. I mean, it's just totally obvious when you have it on. Basically what it is their original quote was the invisible windshield wiper. Although they had to add safety warnings, like, you know, you should use your wipers if you actually need them, because people thought that you could just put this stuff on and not even use your wipers, which you kind of can if you're going fast enough.
Disclaimer, Face Off Show does not condone not using your windshield wipers.
Your wipers. So what Rain-X, you know, in theory, you apply this to your windshield. It's it's like a, I don't know what it is. It's like a wax or like a something that basically makes the rain or the, you know, splashes of snow or whatever on your windshield turn into bigger drops than they normally would. And those drops bead up and then they can roll. It's so, it makes the windshield slick enough to where they actually beat up and they collect and then they roll. And if you go, if you're going about 45, 50 miles an hour, they'll actually roll right off your window. So you kind of don't need your wipers. But if you, you know, if you're having trouble seeing, obviously use your wipers. It's also good for people that are in really snowy climates. Oh, yeah. It really helps with the snow not sticking to your windshield.
I know a couple guys.
Ice buildup and things like that.
I know a couple guys that are in snowy climates right now.
Well, the other thing that's great about this is you get a 3.5 ounce bottle for $1.08, which is super cheap. I still have the same bottle from like probably 3 years ago. And you just apply it maybe once every 2 or 3 months and you're good to go. And it's something that it's kind of cool. It's something, you know, like when your friends get in your car, they'll notice it. You don't have to say anything. If it's raining out, they'll be like, whoa, what's going on here?
Your windshield it's really is awesome.
Kind of exciting.
Yeah, it was funny because you were talking about it's like one of those things that it's always a novelty. Like you put it on and it does wear off. It's not like a permanent treatment or anything like that. It does wear off. But so you'll put it on and like you're like, as you put it on, you're like, wow, look at that water beat off. And then after like a couple months, you know, you're like, man, I should probably Rain-X my windshield again. And then like, you know, another
and
couple.
And then you see it again.
Yeah,
and
you like put it on excited. Like, wow, awesome.
It's both functional and kind of novelty. So, but you know, at a dollar, I would suggest anybody that's, you know, wandering around in the automotive section of their local store or online, grab it and try it out.
You can get the link to Rain-X on the Face Off show notes. You can get a Rain-X original glass treatment 3.5 ounce bottle for only $1.08. Get it at faceoffshow.com. Wow. All right.
I think that was like the best testimonial for Rain-X ever made.
Yeah, absolutely. I think if they don't sponsor us, no one's going to sponsor us. We're screwed. Let's move on to our web apps. Wow. So the first one that we want to talk about, this is like one of those just dead simple, totally fun apps. You know, I do a lot of getting recipes online, and I usually have my laptop kind of perched up above the counter in my kitchen because I have like this little bar area or whatever, and I put the laptop there, put the recipe up. But one of the things, and this is really weird, one of the things I don't have in my house is a kitchen timer. The only kitchen timer we have is on the microwave, and I'm embarrassed to admit this, but I can't figure out how to start the timer without starting the microwave. My wife figured it out somehow. She can put a timer on the microwave to cook, but I can't. So this website, kitchentimer.org, will allow you to set multiple timers for multiple things, all the Ooh. While displaying your recipe side by side. So, So in the upper right-hand corner, you search, and it all it does is just a Google search. So, like, I'm going to search for meatloaf, which happens to be one of my favorite recipes. and, you know, it just does a Google search for meatloaf, so you can find your meatloaf recipe, click on it, and it'll leave it in this little iframe sort of on the right. And then you can say, you know, while you're cooking, you're like, oh, meatloaf, I need a 20-minute timer on the meatloaf, because I'm going to say this timer is for my meatloaf, you know, and I, you know, it's going to take, you know, it's going to take 0 hours, 20 minutes, you know, 30 seconds, and then you say start. And then let's say you're starting your green beans, you know, and all of a sudden you're like, oh man, these green beans have to cook for 10 minutes. Oh, okay, I'm going to add another timer. I'm going to say green beans. And then, you know, they only take like, you know, 5 minutes or whatever. And then you start that timer. And so now I got all these timers sitting there going, and they make this, you know, horribly annoying noise so that when they go off, you know what it is. And it's just a really dead simple, cool little app.
This is great. I recently got a book called, I think it's Cooking for Geeks or something, where it really tries to teach you the different cooking aspects instead of just giving you a bunch of recipes to try out. And so I'm getting a little bit more excited getting into cooking. And this is really cool. I was a little skeptical at first because I didn't know where the recipes are coming from. This iframe makes it dead simple and very useful.
Yeah, just cute little easy web app. Can't beat it. Go get it or go use it at kitchentimer.org. Let's get to our next web app. Mark, there is nothing worse in the world than someone owing you money. Well, I don't know. That's not the worst thing in the world. But, you know, when the thing is, sometimes you're hanging out with your peeps or your crowd, whatever you want to call them, you know, and someone's like, oh, man, I'm out of cash. And you're like, hey, you know what? I'll loan you $5 or something, you know. So, you know, you then you go out and party all night or whatever. And next day you totally forget about it. Or if you remember it, how do you tell that person that they owe you money? You know, it gets awkward sometimes. Our next web app called owemecash.com is a simple way to nag people to pay back their debts. So you can sign in with anything, Twitter, OAuth, Facebook, really easy to do. And then you just go in and you say, I'm going to add a new debt. And I'm going to say, guess who owes me some money? Mark Sanborn owes me some money. He owes me $10. What is the reason? I don't know. Wendy's, because we kind of like Wendy's. I want to send a reminder immediately. And I want to send you a daily reminder because you never pay me back. You are the worst. So at you know, 3 o'clock every day, I want you to send a detail for the phone. I think it calls you. I think it calls you on the phone. I cannot verify that. But they, you can also have them send you a text message and an email, and I create the debt, and it'll start sending you reminders and letting you know that you are a scumbag and you owe me money. So check it out. Dead simple. Really easy to use, and that way, you know. And actually, what's cool is now I've added two debts that you owe me. It actually tells me that Mark Sanborn owes me a total of $15 and shows me the two debts below it.
Awesome. Man, I'm going to have to get a web app to tell me to tell you to turn that off
each day. Hey, no, you pay me back, I'll turn it off, all right?
All right.
I'm going to get my thugs to come over to your house and get some of that.
That's what's really interesting about this web app. It kind of gives you a thug type, you know, appearance. They got that old style hat, like some mob guy is going to come break your legs.
Absolutely. There's kind of like this little thug guy when you sign in and stuff. I'll mark these as paid so you don't get spammed, because I'm cool. I'm a nice guy like that. Anyways, check it out, homiecash.com. Helping, you know, and it's like the funny part is if you do something silly, like use this web app, it's not awkward because it's out in the open. You just say, like, you know, like, I'm going to put it on Omi Cash to make sure you pay me. And it seems funny or whatever, but really it's like you're just trying to remind the guy to pay you back because you want your money back. So check it out, owemecash.com. Hey, if you guys have some news and a follow-up, like we had several this episode, a web application or a geek tool or a question for a topic or anything, go to faceoffshow.com/feedback. Ask us, let us know. You can tweet us out at faceoffshow. You can find us on Facebook. We have a fan page there. Email studio@faceoffshow.com. Anyway, go to faceoffshow.com/feedback. It'll tell you how to get a hold of us. We'd love to hear from you. Please do that. Let's move on to our topic, which is a really interesting one. It's message cues.
Yeah, so we'll start, I guess, with what are they? And I'm going to give you the boring, long, you know, definition just to be formal here. We got message cues provide an asynchronous communication protocol, meaning that the sender and the receiver of the message do not need to interact with the message queue at the same time. In other words, message queues placed into the queue are stored until the recipient retrieves them.
Boring.
So I send a message to the queue, and I don't care if it got there or not. It's going to, you know, it's going to get there, and you can pull that down when you're ready. Maybe you got a lot on your plate. Maybe you know, let's say you're the consumer. I'm the producer. I produce these messages, and you can consume them at your leisure. That's kind of how message queues work. They're one of those things. It's kind of like the Unix philosophy. Do one thing and do them well. Well, the message queues basically just deliver a blob, usually a binary blob. You can throw JSON in there. You could do an image label or a piece of text or maybe even a program, a little script to run. So totally. That's kind of what they are in a nutshell.
And they're pretty useful because, I mean, we talk about this a lot. The key word there is sort of asynchronous, right? You don't want things to be waiting all the time because sometimes things do take time. And so if they're sitting there waiting and waiting, then you have this whole system held up waiting for one thing when really oftentimes the response doesn't matter. Like it just has to be done. So it just, you know, you use a message queue. It says it just fires off a job to the message queue and goes back to what it's doing. The message queue just kind of sits there and just chugs away job after job after job until it's done with jobs. And then it just sits there and waits for another job.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. So probably the most common use for these, especially, you know, among the smaller web apps is worker queues. And so this is like, well, I give you for an example with Agile Task is we check for achievements every time, basically every time a task is dealt with, whether it's deleted or created or updated. Right now, we don't really have super extensive or expensive operations when doing achievement checking, but we may have that a plan for that in the future. If it's taking, let's say it's right now, it's only taking like a second. That's reasonable, you know.
Right.
If in the future, you know, it starts taking 10, 15 seconds to check all the achievements during those operations, well, we don't want to really slow down what the user is doing. So we don't really care. We want to use the asynchronous model. We want to just, you know, check whenever you can and get back to us. So we can send a queue to, we can send a message to the queue, and then our workers can go process and, you know, check for achievements when at their leisure.
Totally.
Another one, I was listening to a podcast about eBay and their architecture, and they're talking about how they separate, a lot of their website is separated into functions, like the selling stuff is separated from the buyer things, which is separated from the search. But all those things are, they have to communicate with each other. For example, the search, the search has to be almost in real time. It's not like Google where they just go and just crawl the web every, let's say, all, you know, all the time, but then they update their indexes once a week maybe to get the newer content. It's changing, it's getting faster and faster, but it used to be like once a month back in the early days of Google. But like eBay, when a seller posts an auction item, they want to be able to be searched like right away.
Right. It's very eBay is very time sensitive. It's a very, everything on it is time sensitive.
So in eBay, when a person lists thing, it also will send a message over to the search saying, here's a new product. You index it as soon as you can. And that's kind of how they go about indexing and adding things to their search.
I see. That makes sense.
That was just one example. I guess their whole architecture is spread out into different functions, and then they message across. Another good thing with messages is you can have different programming languages talking, different businesses, talking to other businesses as things happen. We'll talk about this later, but the messaging stuff was kind of created by the need to do stock trading and things like that, where as soon as this is issued, go and also check the funds are available and do this and do that as well. Another, you know, kind of worker queue type thing is, you know, oftentimes we as users, we upload an image and we want to see that image right away, but also, you know, we might scale that image down. We might make thumbnails. We might add filters over the images. We might put a watermark on them or something. That can all be done behind the scenes while the page, the user is kind of navigating around. And maybe by the time the user gets to their profile page or whatever, those things would be done.
Well, yeah, there's kind of two ways. Like I look at it sort of as two ways. There's like the stuff where you're trying to fire it off asynchronously because you don't want to affect the user interface. And you see this in the web a lot. Like we were talking about, like, you don't want the user to sit and wait for these images to be resized, even if it takes 15 seconds. 15 seconds is a long time in user interface land. So you fire off that little job that takes a while. And, you know, oftentimes maybe by the time they even click a link or anything like that, it's done in the background. But to them, you know, it was really quick. It was really fast. And then the other thing is things that really honestly do take a long time as well. And it's not really about user interface there. It's just like, go process these. They're going to take a while. And, you know, it's just a way to help sort of, you know, organize it for the system to handle it. You know, it's like, because you can have, and it's interesting, like you were saying, that eBay uses it everywhere, because it's just like, you know, pew, I get to see if it was like a little, you know, a little visualization with like ray guns, just be like pew, 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 pew all over the place.
Yeah.
It's just going crazy.
Another example might be generating graphs or things that, you know, are computationally expensive. But, you know, a lot of times graphs, we look at them like GitHub has a lot of graphs with the Git data and things. And I could imagine that those are updated only maybe, let's say, every 15 minutes, you know, and they don't have to be updated in real time. But it would be nice if they're fairly up to date. Right. And, you know, message queues would be great for something like that.
Or
and
like
I don't know
with
GitHub.
Oh, go. I'm go sorry. Ahead. It's like, or like with GitHub, when someone does push, it can fire off a job to the, you know, message queue to say process this stuff, you know, in order of whatever. But, you know, they don't have to be actually integrated system, like you're saying, different languages and stuff. We were when I was at Mountain West Ruby Conf, it was funny, they were doing some math calculations in like Ruby versus Haskell, and, you know, and Haskell was just lightning fast. But they were trying to make like a software bridge, but really, you know, you could just use a messaging system if you want. You know, Ruby fires off a, you know, a blob to the messaging system. The messaging system, you know, runs some Haskell using that blob, and then you get the speed of both without having to build like an actual software bridge.
Yeah, I mean, the motivation behind message queues is almost always scalability and speed. And, you know, let's say, you know, it's GitHub starts processing these images and they have one server, and all of a sudden they're like, well, this server's like always backed up. It's taken a long time to get through and it's never at idle. They could add another consumer that's just does the same thing, and you're scaling, and totally. You just keep adding computers.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's a message, so it can go to either one. You could have a load balancer that sends, you know, that alternates like this server and other server, this server, other server, so that you can load balance and scale pretty easily. Yeah, that's a great point.
It doesn't also always have to be like a worker queue. You can send multicast messages out. Let's say you have software and you want to check for updates. You can actually push updates to software. They can just connect and just sit there and wait.
Oh, yeah.
And then something I'm experimenting with, and this is kind of why I kind of looked up the message queues, was a way to have something sitting there, but not like I have something I need to push out, and I didn't want to just do polling where I check the same URL all the time for something new. And it seems like message queues were kind of built for that. So what I kind of thought of was having a print server that's just waiting for, you know, for Rocketship, I have a print server that's waiting for print jobs, and you send it from the web browser, and, you know, it pushes out to the printer and it prints it out.
Totally.
Which is cool because it scales too. You could add another printer, and then it'll load balance the two jobs, and you could have two shippers printing two labels at the same time. And
oh my goodness, that's ridiculous.
It's like that.
No, that sounds like a good idea.
So the protocol that is commonly used is AMQP. There's a few other ones, but this one seems to be the most popular. This was created by JP Morgan Chase & Company, so it's, you know, pretty big. It's been around for a while. Mm-hmm. Some of the people that are working on it is Microsoft, Red Hat, Cisco, Bank of America.
Is that a protocol?
Yes, that is an open protocol. And it's
odds are you probably won't be like directly using that in your app. You'll probably have something that uses that protocol, right? But these are the guys that first developed. They're like, hey, we need a way to do these, you know, these message queue systems. Let's create a protocol, and then, you know, we'll standardize and everyone can use it, and we'll make it good. Because apparently, yeah, I mean, there's some big names in there too. So one can probably be rest assured that it was well thought out and well implemented, and probably went through like, you know, what would you call it, like bureaucracy loops to make sure that everything was well thought of.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of them. There's ActiveMQ, which is Apache-based one. ZeroMQ, which I just heard about on Hacker News or Git or Reddit, one of the two, which is supposed to be really fast. But it doesn't follow the AMQP, perfectly. It's like it's got a plugin for it or something like that, but it's supposed to be really fast. And then there's RabbitMQ, which is the open source AMQP that seems to be really popular. This one's used by Reddit. A lot of these also have a REST front end, so if you're kind of familiar with that, you can, you know, or like maybe you want to have it as part of, you know, part of your API is sending a message or getting messages, you could have that part of the REST.
REST is like a great way to interact with these sort of systems. Totally.
Almost all of these are language agnostic. I mean, it is a protocol, and so like RabbitMQ, for example, supports everything from PHP to Perl to Python, Ruby, pretty much all of them, C, C++, whatever.
So let's say though, you know, I don't want to use AMQP. There are other alternatives out there, right?
Yeah, Amazon's got a proprietary one called SQS, which, you know, the advantage here is if you're using EC2 and some of those things, it integrates really well with those.
Totally.
You don't have to worry with Amazon SQS. You don't have to worry about making like a cluster of AMQP servers.
Yeah.
It's all handled for you. You just send your messages and get them back.
Yeah. It's the same thing Amazon uses. So, I mean, it's robust and it's got, you know, a pretty strong backend.
And then there's also some projects. I'll add some more here that I forgot to put on here. But like they're basically, they run on top. They're either their own implementations or they run on top of things like RabbitMQ. Like, for example, Celery and Carrot are two examples that run on top of RabbitMQ, but they're made for specifically Celery, for example, is, I think, the worker one. That's okay. Like, it's specific for doing worker stuff. So if you don't want to be bothered by the message, like, make sure this message has multiple recipient, you know, or, yeah, you know, if you don't want to do the message part of it and you want to do like kind of the worker queue model, you can just do that. And it makes it simple for just that. One that we looked at was Beanstalk D, which is a Ruby one that allows, it's basically for worker queue. Mm-hmm. And so if you're getting started with them, or if you think you have a use case for them, maybe check those out first to get a little grip on how they work, and then before you switch over to the other ones, or because they, I mean, if you're just doing a worker queue, you might, they're probably going to be easier to implement than a full blown AMQP setup from, yep, you know, using something like RabbitMQ. And then another thing that's worth reading is Second Life's evaluation of message queues. They have a huge use case for them, and they have millions and millions of messages to send constantly. I think the one that they were sending 4 million messages a second.
My goodness.
And it was handling it just fine, I guess. And they evaluate each one with their use cases. Your use case is not going to be the same as theirs, of course, but it's worth reading if you're interested in message queues.
Yeah, totally. A lot of information in that article, so that's really good. Check it out if you're interested. That wraps it up for this episode of Face Off. I want to remind you, if you haven't subscribed to the show yet, go to faceoffshow.com/subscribe. You can do there. You can do that there if you want. Also, again, leave feedback, give us tips, anything, ask us questions, go to faceoffshow.com/feedback. You can get all the links there. Next week is our 100th episode, so we're totally pumped about that. So we do have a request. Why don't you send us a message and tell us what your favorite moment, favorite topic, favorite illuminating thing about the past 100 episodes has been. We would appreciate it, you know, at Face Off Show on Twitter, or, you know, studio@faceoffshow.com. Let us know. We'd love to mention some of these in our 100th episode, and hopefully we will see you next week for our Centurion episode of awesome. Thanks for listening, guys. We appreciate it.